Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm your host, Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, E. coli, the good, the bad, and the ugly. We couldn't live without these bacteria in our guts to help in the digestion of food, but rogue E. coli like O157 of Walkerton fame do cause us grief. Dr. Glenn Armstrong at the University of Alberta is working on innovative treatments for humans, while Dr. Malcolm Rollins and Brian Manning of the Alberta Research Council are involved in commercialization of an E. coli vaccine for cattle. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. E. coli. When they're good, which is most of the time, we don't even know they're there. When they're bad, well, it's downright ugly, as the people in Walkerton well know. Last spring, a calamity of events left several people dead in this Ontario town when E. coli 0157 contaminated their drinking water. Some of those victims tried an experimental treatment developed by Dr. Glenn Armstrong, a professor of medical microbiology at the University of Alberta. He's researching how the many different E. coli bacteria function in an effort to develop human treatments for infection.
The normal E. coli that we have growing in our intestines, when they use food that we eat, they can break that food down and they can produce metabolic byproducts. And some of these metabolic byproducts the bacteria make are actually vitamins that we can acquire from the bacteria that we're unable to make ourselves. So that's one benefit that we derive from having these normal E. coli in our intestines. Another benefit is that just by sheer numbers, these normal E. coli in our intestines basically prevent any pathogenic organisms from becoming established in our intestine, because they basically consume all of the nutrients that are available in those sites. So a pathogenic organism coming along really has no nutrients, so it's unable to really grow well. So that's another benefit that the normal E. coli can give us.
So then what about these bad ones?
Well, what the bad ones, many of the bad bacteria, what they've done is they've acquired genes somehow from other bacteria, and this enables them to produce what we call virulence factors that enable them to actually do damage to our intestines, and it's this damage to the intestines that we see as the clinical symptoms in diseases that these bacteria cause, like the diarrhea or the bloody diarrhea that E. coli 0157 produces. And one of the virulence factors that they produce enables them to actually colonize intestinal epithelial cells in a region of the intestine where there's actually very few of the normal bacteria. So there's a lot more nutrients there for this for the E. coli to grow.
This rogue E. coli, it normally doesn't inhabit the human intestine. How is it that we're picking it up and it's killing us off?
Well, it's still a lot of speculation yet, but it appears that in the case of E. coli 0157, the natural host for this organism is the gastrointestinal tract of cattle. And so the genes that this organism has acquired from other bacteria or from the environment, really it's acquired these genes in order to help it survive in its preferred environment, which is the gastrointestinal tract of cattle. So, of course, the organisms are living in cattle, in the gastrointestinal tract of cattle, and the organisms then are being shed from the cattle in manure. And so if the organisms from the manure get into, say, groundwater, for instance, or if they get onto some food products, and then that water, if that water is not treated properly to kill any bacteria that might be in it, or if the food is not prepared properly to kill the bacteria, then if humans eat or drink anything contaminated with these organisms, they can go into the human intestines, and the genes that they've acquired that help them survive in cattle allow them to cause clinical disease in humans. Probably humans are not the preferred host for these organisms, and the fact that they cause disease in humans is a pure accident.
What is it that you've been working on in order to deal with treatment for these rogue E. coli and the disease-causing aspects of them?
Okay, well, I mentioned the fact that rogue E. coli, one of the virulence traits that they've acquired is the ability to colonize parts of the intestine where the good E. coli are not normally found. Many of these rogue E. coli also produce potent toxins. And in the majority of cases, it's actually the toxins that the bacteria produce that are responsible for the serious complications of these infections. In the case of E. coli 0157, these organisms produce toxins that are related to toxins that are also produced by the organisms that cause shigellosis in humans. And we know that if these toxins get out of the intestines and get into the circulation of patients that have an E. coli 0157 infection, these toxins can have very nasty effects in the kidneys and on the central nervous system. And it's the kidney effects, the renal failure, and the problems associated with damage to the central nervous system that are really responsible for the life-threatening complications that these patients get with these infections. So the treatment that I've been working on, the potential treatment that I've been working on, is designed primarily at neutralizing the toxins that those bacteria produce, prevent those toxins from getting into the circulation and doing their damage to the kidneys and the central nervous system.
How would that work? What could you do?
We knew that the toxins that E. coli 0157 produce bind specifically to a carbohydrate molecule that is present on target cells in humans. And this molecule that these toxins bind to actually is a trisaccharide molecule, carbohydrate. And we call that a receptor. It's actually the receptor on the host cell that the toxins bind to. And we have an expertise here at the University of Alberta in the ability to chemically synthesize these molecules that that we know that toxins like the E. coli toxin bind to. So we can take these chemically synthesized derivatives of these receptor molecules that the toxins bind to on the host cells. And in this case, these sugars were actually coupled to very fine sand particles, totally indigestible, highly porous sand particles. And so by binding these sugar molecules to these sand particles, I was able to show in my lab that these sand particles would act like little molecular sponges that would literally just suck the toxin up from solutions containing the toxin. And so the hypothesis was that if we can identify patients with an E. coli 0157 infection soon enough and feed these patients this sugar-coated sand material, that this would go down into the intestines, it would soak up any of the toxins that the bacteria are making, and because it's totally indigestible and it wouldn't be broken down in the intestines, it's just passed right out of the body, it would take the toxins with it. So this would be material that could specifically soak up the toxins the organisms make and allow the toxins to be harmlessly eliminated from the body rather than being absorbed into the body.
So how far along are you in developing this?
Well, the company that is responsible for developing this is a company called Synzor Biotech Inc., and it operates in Calgary. They've just completed a phase 3 clinical trial with this product, and it shows that our theory about how this material can work is partially correct, but it also reveals that we still have more research to do in order to improve the effectiveness of this approach of treatment even further.
What are some of those areas then that you have to look at now?
Well, I believe that one of the reasons why this sugar-coated sand is not completely effective is that not all the toxin that the bacteria produces goes into the core of or the lumen of the intestine first. That some of the toxin that the bacteria produces is actually absorbed directly. It's actually injected by the bacteria directly into the intestinal epithelial cells, where it can then pass through the intestinal epithelium and get into the circulation that way. So what we need to do now is we need to develop a soluble form of this sugar molecule that can be given as a pill and absorbed into the body, or given as an injection into the body so that it can get into the circulation and it can neutralize that toxin that gets out of the intestines and gets into the circulatory system. And again, in collaboration with my collaborator, David Bundle, in the Department of Chemistry here at the U of A, we've come up with a soluble form of this Synsorb particle that can do just that. And we've just finished and are in the process now of testing this soluble form of Synsorb in an animal model that we have for this infection. And the results that we've obtained so far are extremely encouraging in that we are able, with this soluble form of the drug, to completely protect, 100% protect, mice that have been exposed to this toxin with this soluble form of Synsorb. So we feel that it's possible that the combination of the sugar-coated sand particles in the intestine, along with an absorbable form of the drug, if given together, this could dramatically enhance the effectiveness of this way of treating these infections, the E. coli 0157 infections.
What other E. coli organisms are you working on?
Well, the other one I'm working on is related to E. coli 0157. It's the organism responsible for causing diarrhea in very young children in developing countries. It's called enteropathogenic E. coli. And it's turning out to be a very interesting study because by studying this organism, we're starting to find that that bacteria are very good at sensing their environment and detecting their host cells. And that when bacteria, like enteropathogenic E. coli, initially make contact with their host cell, this actually initiates a very complex dialogue between the bacteria and the host cell. And this dialogue is composed of biochemical signals that the bacteria gives to the host cell, and then the bacteria also receives biochemical signals from the host cell. The net effect of this dialogue in enteropathogenic E. coli is that the organism actually causes the host cell to alter its behavior in order to become more accommodating to the bacteria, and the bacteria at the same time alters its behavior in order to adapt to the changing host cell environment. So this is turning out to be very exciting research because we have now the tools and the technology that enables us to actually identify all of the biochemical molecules and their targets that are involved in this chemical dialogue or biochemical dialogue that the bacteria and their host cell engage in during the infection process. And so this gives us a whole bunch of other brand new potential targets for directing anti-infective therapies at. If we can identify these precise pathways, we may be able to come up with new molecules that are able to antagonize these processes and prevent these dialogues from occurring, and that way prevent the bacteria from causing infections in humans. So we think by studying enteropathogenic E. coli, we're starting to reveal a common strategy that a lot of pathogenic organisms have evolved in order to cause disease. And so we think by learning more about these pathways, we'll have a lot more information that we can use for developing even more sophisticated anti-infective drugs.
Any clues yet as how you might antagonize or interrupt that process to develop a treatment?
Well, one of the clues is that one of the first signals that I believe that the enteropathogenic E. coli detects when it binds to its host cell is it's able to learn from the carbohydrate sequences on the surface of the host cell exactly what the cell is that it's stuck to. So it's able to detect its host cell by identifying the very specific carbohydrate sequences that it's binding to on the host cell, and that the very first signal that the bacteria receives from the host cell is the attachment, the physical attachment of the organism to those carbohydrate sequences. That my research is directed at trying to demonstrate the feasibility of using host cell analogs of those carbohydrate sequences to antagonize the very initial signaling events that the bacteria engages in when it sets up this biochemical dialogue. So we want to stop the dialogue before it really even gets started, is a shorter way of saying that. So by using these chemicals, we can actually prevent the bacteria from even being able to identify its host cell in the first place, so that it doesn't even start an infection process.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I was speaking with Dr. Glenn Armstrong, a professor and researcher in medical microbiology at the University of Alberta. Coming up, a vaccine that gets at the source of E. coli 0157. While Dr. Glenn Armstrong is working on treatments for E. coli infection in humans, Dr. Malcolm Rollins is taking a different approach. He's working on a vaccine for cattle, the source of E. coli 0157. Malcolm is a scientist with the Alberta Research Council, and as part of a joint effort with other groups, his focus is on developing the technology that would help commercialize the vaccine. I asked him first about the different E. coli bacteria in the stomachs of cattle.
The different strains of E. coli that inhabit the gut of livestock is actually dependent on the diet that the livestock are subjected to. It actually varies from farm to farm, from location to location. But needless to say, there are many different strains that are quite beneficial and aid in digestion of the food in the animal. But there are some strains that are not so beneficial, and the particular strain that we are working with, the 0157 pathogen, doesn't actually harm the beef cattle or dairy cattle at all. They just act as a carrier for that pathogen.
Does it affect any other animals?
Yeah, well, it does. It is carried by other animals, so pigs and sheep will also carry it. But the major threat at the moment is, just through sheer numbers, is the beef cattle industry and the dairy cattle industry. But it doesn't actually cause disease in these animals.
Is this a normal E. coli within the livestock? Or is it something that has mutated and it just doesn't cause a problem for them?
Yeah, it is one of many pathogens in the environment, and it's probably always been present, but it is true to say that only in the last 20 or 30 years has it become a major concern, and I don't think anyone really knows why. Perhaps it's the use of antibiotics that are effective against some pathogens, but not particularly effective against the 0157 pathogen. So you're selecting for particular pathogens in the environment, or it could be the diet of the animals, or how the animals are farmed or distributed. No one really knows. But as far as the environment is concerned, it is becoming one of the more prominent pathogens of the E. coli species.
You're working with a vaccine for E. coli that would be used with cattle. How was this originally developed or discovered?
It was discovered by a researcher at the University of British Columbia, and he was actually looking at developing a vaccine for humans. So if you can prevent the colonization of the pathogen in humans, then of course you should be able to prevent disease in the humans. And it just so happens that the discoveries he was making were also applicable to animals that normally carried the pathogen but didn't develop disease themselves. And so the Veterinary Infectious Disease Organization in Saskatoon took that application of the technology and developed it further. And it's that veterinary application that the Alberta Research Council is working with and further developing.
Could you explain a little bit more about how the vaccine actually works?
Yes, the vaccine is composed of proteins that actually form part of the method that the pathogen uses to colonize the gut of the animal. And so by injecting the animal with these proteins, the animal raises antibodies, an immune response against those proteins. So whenever a pathogen is ingested by a cattle, for example, then that has been vaccinated, then the animal develops an immune response which not only reduces the numbers of pathogens that colonize the gut, but also actually decolonizes existing pathogens. So it's a way of cleaning up the animals as well.
In your day-to-day work at the council then, what kinds of things are you doing in order to reach that goal? What are the technologies or the techniques or the scientific experimentation that goes on to take it from what the researchers in the lab were doing when they first discovered it, and now that you're at the stage of trying to develop it to a larger level?
Well, we have quite a lot of specialized equipment which allows us to control many of the environmental factors that are variables in the culturing of this organism. In the laboratory, there's not a lot of control whenever they culture the organism. And we apply more controls and find out what's important in the expression of the important proteins that we use in the vaccine. So we look at things like different media compositions, different dissolved oxygen concentrations, different points at which we harvest the culture for the product, and different ways of processing the product once we've produced it as well.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
That was Dr. Malcolm Rollins. He's the project manager in fermentation at the Alberta Research Council. Also part of the cattle vaccine project is Brian Manning. He looks after the business end of commercializing the E. coli vaccine. And as he explains, the project involves several partners.
The first aspect of our role has been to bring together the parties necessary to take the university research and to transform that into a product that can be taken out to the marketplace. So we became involved with the researchers and inventors of the vaccine who were at University of British Columbia and the Veterinary Infectious Diseases Organization. We have negotiated agreements with them through the Network Centers of Excellence, the Canadian Bacterial Diseases Network. And having done that, then we in turn have negotiated a license with a commercial entity, BioNiche Life Sciences, so that they can sell the product and get it out into the marketplace.
So this sounds like a pretty big role that you have here. What's involved in actually taking that early laboratory research and getting it to a point where you've got something that you can put right on the market?
Well, it's a significant investment on our part, and we have funded the development research that basically takes the vaccine from the researcher's bench where it's produced in dozens of doses, and we are developing a process, a manufacturing process, that will yield millions of doses because there are 30 million cattle out there that we all hope will be vaccinated with this product. So to go from the dozens to the millions is not like scaling up a cake. In fact, even with a cake, as you know, you might double a recipe, but if you try to five times a recipe, it would in fact fail. And the same is the case sometimes with scaling up scientific research, that something that works on the bench in small scale needs to be modified in order to move it forward to commercial scale. And that's what we're involved in here.
Now, why go with a vaccine rather than use some sort of other treatment or deal with the problem in other ways?
We looked at the various options for solving the problem as part of our decision to make an investment in this area. One of the initial questions was, should it be a human vaccine or an animal vaccine? And in fact, when you look at despite the fact that this is a very serious issue and it has very serious consequences, the at-risk population is really quite small. And doing a human vaccine, is extremely difficult to do. If you look at the gargantuan effort that was required to do the meningitis vaccine just in Edmonton. Imagine, trying to do a human vaccine against E. coli for all citizens of Canada or anybody that lives near cattle. I mean, it would be extremely difficult to do. Almost a logistical impossibility. Not to mention the very, very high expense of producing a vaccine that would be safe for use in humans. So that decision was fairly easy to say, well, it ought to be an animal vaccine. And then we looked at the competing technologies that, was this vaccine really necessary? Why couldn't something be done with meat? And we realized that the routes by which the E. coli bacteria gets to humans is not exclusively through meat. That, as we've seen with Walkerton, it comes through groundwater, it comes through crops that have been irrigated with polluted water, and so there are a variety of means by which the E. coli gets to humans. So getting to the cattle, which is the source of the E. coli, seemed to be the most sensible solution, and so that's the approach we've taken, and I believe that we've taken the right one, so that we are now really focused on getting to the cattle at the source. So you won't hear us refer much to hamburger disease, which is a term that was quite popular, because this isn't just exclusively hamburger disease. There are a number of ways that humans can come into contact with E. coli. And each of those ways can lead to disastrous results. And so our intent is to get to the source and to reduce the risk to humans.
Do you have any other animal vaccines you're working on?
We do have an animal vaccine development program. It is our primary emphasis of our biotechnology department here. We are in the process of developing vaccines for other animal diseases. None at this time with the human health component that that we're aware of with E. coli. We're more interested in the making animals more commercially saleable because they lose weight when they're sick and so forth, and so we're dealing with animal illnesses. The E. coli program is quite unique because of its human health benefits.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure to talk to you.
That was Brian Manning, an account manager in technology commercialization at the Alberta Research Council. For more information on the E. coli vaccine for cattle, you can check out the Council's website at arc.ab.ca. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Visit our website at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.